25 years ago, no one, and I mean no one, would have predicted that a little budget classical label out of Hong Kong called Naxos would totally upend the classical music industry. After doing everything pretty much counter to received wisdom, Naxos's catalog now includes more than 7,000 recordings, and they've sold more than 115 million CDs worldwide. Its very popular streaming service, the Naxos Music Library, holds nearly a million tracks of music. Naxos's founder, Klaus Hamann, is here with us today to play guest DJ. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Happy to be in your program.
If you can take us back a little bit to your life pre-Naxos. You were born in Germany, though you've now been based in Hong Kong for many, many years. Did you grow up in a musical family at all?
No, but my parents only ever played classical music at home, so I never heard anything else. So I guess I grew up in a musical family, in a passive musical family, but nobody played an instrument. I went to lots of concerts, and I went to my very first one when I was only 9 years old. And I got hooked.
What was that concert?
That was 3 months after the end of the Second World War in a little spa town in the Bavarian Alps, where we had been evacuated to evade the bombing attacks on our German cities. And we went across the lake and listened to the Munich Philharmonic play Leonore III, Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 4, and Schubert Unfinished Symphony. Couldn't think of a more popular hackneyed program, but for me, it was a revelation. And of course, Leonora III was fascinating because there was a trumpet player off stage. So I said, where does the trumpet sound come from? So you have to be really careful how you introduce a kid, a young person, to classical music. Descriptive music will do very well. Four Seasons, Pastoral Symphony, those are all wonderful introductions. Oh, that's a thunderstorm brewing, and the birds singing. So it's important.
And it's funny you bring up Four Seasons in particular, considering that's by far been one of Naxos's great successes.
That's our biggest selling disc, biggest selling single disc.
And how many copies is
it? More than 1.5 million now. The few record stores that took us, they dumped our records into a bin in a corner because they didn't want to have our cheap stuff among all the good labels. So we didn't really have much choice in the beginning.
It was a very different time and place where budget was really anathema in certain respects.
Well, it was unknown. It was the first budget CD label. Now, in a way, we were lucky because out of this bin in the corner of the record shop, then eventually grew the separate Naxos White Walls.
So tell us a little bit about your wife and how she's come to such prominence at Naxos.
I met her when she came to Hong Kong to play the Wieniawski Second Violin Concerto in 1974. I met her because I was a founder of the Hong Kong Philharmonic Orchestra. I was the honorary general manager, because that means I did all the work and didn't get paid, and I was the chairman of the fundraising committee.
There's the honor, right?
That's the honor. So I met her at the airport. Her manager had called me from Japan, said, would I take care of her while she's in Hong Kong? I went to the airport. I met her. We got together late that evening, and we had a cup of tea. We started at 8 o'clock, and we ended up like 1 o'clock in the morning and kept talking about music, and she was surprised how much I knew. And I was surprised how charming she was and very cute also. So we clicked and we were married 5-6 months later. And so then we got married. She moved from Japan to Hong Kong and really had nothing to do. And for her, I really started the record business because I had to keep her busy, which is what I had promised her dad when I had asked him for permission to marry her. She's the artist advisor. I'm the repertoire advisor in
the
company.
I see.
She decides who gets recorded. I decide what gets recorded.
I want to turn to a recording by your wife, the Butterfly Lovers Concerto. That was Takako Nishizaki,
yes,
performing the Butterfly Lovers Concerto.
It became an enormous success. At first, she didn't really like the music, but then as she started practicing the piece, she realized that there were wonderful melodies, that it's a very effective lyrical and dramatic piece at the same time. And it tells the story of these two lovers, star-crossed lovers, and it became a huge success, although people initially thought the Japanese could not play that piece. But she actually didn't know the story when she made the first recording. So she played it like it were a Tchaikovsky concerto, like it were a great piece of classical music. And it had tremendous success. And then she recorded after, I think, 6 more times.
Wow. So what, at this point in Naxos's evolution, are you looking for in terms of repertoire?
Well, first of all, we still have some gaps in our standard repertoire. For example, right now we recorded the complete Rossini overtures. There's still no complete recording in the market. We are trying to find a good forces to record the complete Mozart sacred music, which we don't have. We only have the Requiem and one other Mass. I would like to record all the Mozart divertimenti and serenades, even for those for some very unusual instrumental combinations. So that is the first aim of every year's recording program, fill the few remaining gaps. Then we look at repertoire areas that are not yet well covered at all.
And then what would you say that your wife is looking for artistically?
She now looks at, for example, as part of this project, the Italian project, we're going to record the violin concertos of Castelnuovo Tedesco. And, of course, we have a young Chinese star violinist now on the label, Tianhua Yang, so she will record that. And there's no argument between myself and my wife that she's going to record that. We have other star artists, and we have to find things for them to record. And we now go back to the catalog and say, okay, I think we should do this one again. This is from the early days of the label. It is no longer up to present day standards. So let's do it again. And which artists, which orchestra are going to do this with? So she's involved in that process.
I just want to go back a little bit to something we were just talking about, which was being based in Hong Kong. And, you know, obviously you've worked over the years with many Asian artists and with many ensembles. But when you started, Naxos was kind of at a geographic periphery. You know, it was really at the outer edges. And in the ensuing decades, it's hard not to talk about East Asia and China in particular and the entire region as being one of the real epicenters of classical music. Did you see that coming?
No, not really when we started.
Or even in the year since. Would you have said 15 years ago that this would be so?
Well, Japan was always a big market for classical music. So that was there 25 years ago already. They didn't like Naxos because Japan was full price. If it's cheap, it cannot be good. That was the attitude in the early days. China at that time was still closed to Western music, and we couldn't sell any of our music in China. It's still difficult because it's mainly controlled by piracy. I think only 1% of the total market is legitimate. The remaining 99% are pirated. Korea was a good market in the early days for the label. It's still a good market, but not in physical form anymore. We're selling more downloads and subscriptions than we sell physical CDs. Hong Kong is not a bad market. Singapore is limited, and those are probably the four markets in Asia where you can sell classical music. China has great potential if they ever go legitimate, because they have these millions of kids learning to play the piano and learning to play the violin. I think 35 million playing the piano. It's amazing. And the number of pianists coming out of China is just stunning.
But as you said, I mean, when you have a market that easily 90% plus is pirated recordings, that creates a very difficult scenario in which to create any benchmarks.
But when we started the label, we did not think of China. But we always thought, being in Hong Kong, that we needed to think worldwide because our local market was so limited. I never thought of the Hong Kong market when planning a recording session, whereas many of our competitors, like Hyperion, they think of England first, or Chandos is an English label. Harmonia Mundi thinks first of the French market. We always thought about where can we sell it in the States, can we sell it in England, can we sell it in Germany and in Japan and in France. Those are the five big international classical markets that account maybe for 75% of the total business. So we always thought of those five markets when thinking about repertoire.
Mm-hmm. And of those, of the ones you listed, which is the biggest selling market for you now?
Well, now it's the United States by far, not only because physical sales are very strong still here, but because it's so far ahead of the rest of the world in digital activities, downloads, all the big platforms are domiciled here. The biggest mail order operator in the world is domiciled here. We now get paid by digital broadcasters, which we didn't get by terrestrial broadcasters in the past. So there are many things happening here that where the U.S. is way ahead of the rest of the world. And so this is by far our biggest and our most profitable market.
Well, that actually leads me, not intentionally, but very neatly, into a discussion of a recording with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra. Let's hear a bit of music by Howard Hanson. That's an excerpt from the Marymount Suite by Howard Hanson, and that comes from Noxus's American Classics series. That, I think, has become a really essential series for a lot of American classical music lovers because it's introduced or reintroduced a lot of very important music that has, I think, in some ways gotten lost in the wash, especially of mid-century music. And not only do I like it because of the music, but it also features an American orchestra, the Nashville Symphony, and Kenneth Skirmerhorn is conducting. And it's kind of interesting because Noxus has developed a very strong tie in particular to the city of Nashville. Very close to Nashville is where your American operation is based now. Was that decision to base Noxus very near the epicenter of country music, was that something that you had considered for, again, logistical reasons?
Well, that was really an accident in a way. We had originally started our company in New Jersey, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. But we ran into a lot of problems with the company. The city and the state were not very supportive. And then I had problems with my CEO and had to replace him. And the CEO of our Swedish company had a friend in Nashville who was also in the Christian music business. And this gentleman, Jim Sturgeon, eventually agreed to become our new CEO. And initially he commuted between Nashville and Cherry Hill. But he called me a few months later and says, Klaus, this company is hopeless. Let's close it down and start from scratch in Nashville. And I have a network in Nashville. I can easily build a new team. And that's the advice I took. It was probably the best advice, probably the second most important good advice I had ever taken.
Sorry, I have to ask, what was the first?
Starting Naxos. That was the best. So we moved the company to Nashville. And at the opening, we had an opening reception at the Parthenon. You know, they have a replica of the Parthenon in Nashville. And that was Kenneth Skirmerhorn. And I knew he would be there because we had made recordings with him in Hong Kong before. He was music director of the Hong Kong Philharmonic. And one of his recordings, of Sibelius' Tone Poems, had actually won a gold award in terms of sales. It sold more than 100,000 copies. So I handed him his gold award with about, I think, 5 years delay. And then we started talking about recording with Nashville because we had started the American Classic Series outside of the United States. So then the Nashville Symphony became the first American orchestra that recorded for the American Classic Series, which has been tremendously important for the image of our label in this country.
So what do you think, either in terms or actually in both terms of financial success and artistic success, which of the American Classics recordings would you pinpoint?
William Balcom, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, which gave us 3 Grammys. We've done very well with Bernstein's Mass. The Barber series with Marion Alsop, although that was recorded in Scotland.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of The Barber. We're going to hear an excerpt from his Medea Suite in a recording with Marion Alsop and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. That was Marion Alsop conducting music by Samuel Barber, and we heard an excerpt of the Medea Suite, and obviously Marion Alsop, who is a good friend, I should say, of NPR Classical, and she writes for us quite frequently and appears on NPR quite frequently, but she seems to become a real force at Naxos as well, and it's been grown into quite a partnership. What do you appreciate about her musicality?
What I love about Marion is she's a wonderful, natural musician. And I think she gets almost everything just right. She makes real music. And she's also a very reasonable person. You can talk to her in a common sense way. I don't have to call her maestra or anything like that. I say, hi, Marion, how are things, you know? And we can chat. And she also shares my passion for education. We're working on a big education project now with her.
I do want to talk a little bit about the panoply of other endeavors that Naxos now encompasses. There's the digital service, there's the educational projects, there's obviously becoming a huge force in distribution of other labels. So were you all along trying to plant seeds for other commercial endeavors and educational endeavors?
I personally think that educating the next generation of listeners is very important. So from the very beginning, we've put a lot of emphasis on creating education products. In the beginning, there were CDs with books with CDs. The Naxos Music Library, which is probably now the most popular listening service for and a database for classical music in the world, started out as an education project for universities and music schools. Then we went into audiobooks. Now we are focusing on apps, on ebooks with embedded music. So we are always looking at the next generation of services and products we can produce. And in the process, we've become an IT company with a record company as an appendix. We have 75 people in IT, including all our musicologists, and only 10 people running the record business.
I was looking through a book that's newly published called The Story of Naxos, The Extraordinary Story of the Independent Record Label That Changed Classical Recording Forever. That is quite an assertion to make. But I think at least as of a couple of years ago, I know you were saying that streaming really was fundamental to the business and the sustaining business model for classical music. Would you still say now in 2012 that that's where we are?
Incidentally, I didn't make that assertion. That's a publisher. The publisher to promote the book. I'm not that big-headed. But going
I'm glad to hear that.
But going back to streaming, we started our first streaming site in 1996, and it was not a commercial effort, but the idea was to allow people to listen to a track online and then hopefully go to the record shop and buy the recording. And then in 2002, when bandwidth started to get cheaper, then I saw a business model there. And then we organized the first subscription streaming service in the universe, and that was basically addressed at universities, music schools, public libraries, and so on. So that was long before the advent of Spotify and Deezer and other streaming services that are now hitting the market. I think in the long run, that will be the way people consume music, classical music and other music. And I think if I look at my crystal ball, I would say 5 years from now, 50% of that business for our business will be all kinds of streaming services, including digital broadcasters. And I think that's how people will consume music. Apple is now starting also a digital broadcast service along the lines of Pandora. And I mean, we still will sell CDs 5 years from now, and we will still sell downloads. And I don't think downloads will go away completely, but I think half the business will be some kind of streaming service or digital broadcast service.
Do you think that that's going to be more on-demand services, that I want to hear X piece of music right now, or sort of more passive broadcast experience?
Well, I think primarily it will be an on-demand service. Naxos Music Library is an on-demand service. You go on the site and you put in a keyword search, what do you want to listen to, and click, and all the available versions come up. You click the one you want to hear, and that's what you listen to. Spotify is similar. Spotify is also an on-demand service, except the search is not very good for classical music. That's why we're building one that will work on Spotify. But Deezer has slightly better, that comes out of France, has slightly better search. Some of the other services have varying degrees of search quality. But I think that's the way half the streaming audience will listen. The other half will probably listen to digital broadcasters, but they will allow, like Pandora, building your own programming.
Do you feel that the traditional CD business, or frankly, I can even say this now, the LP, the resurgence or small resurgence of an LP business, do you think those are going to be any factors?
Well, that's a niche market. I've been discussing this with my people. They try to persuade me to release a few LPs, and I said, look, all our recordings are digital. It makes absolutely no sense to release a digital recording on an LP, which is an analog medium. If we had a huge library of analog, high-quality analog master tapes on the label, I would say, okay, let's transfer those and try a few LPs. But, of course, now the argument is that there's now a lot of high-resolution recordings, even in our case. So releasing a high-resolution recording in an analog format might make sense. But I said, don't ask me again. You want to do it, and it fails, you do have to take the blame.
One of the recordings you selected was by the Uzbek-born pianist Eldar Nebulsin. Tell me a little bit about how you came to work with him.
Eldar had actually a very big career when he was a much younger man. He won the Santander piano competition, then got a contract with Decca, had a huge career but felt he wasn't ready for it, quit the big career, went back to his teacher in Russia, studied again, and then reemerged at age 30 by winning the first Richter competition. And then a well-known producer, Decca producer Paul Myers, who sits on the Santander jury, he contacted him and said, Klaus, you've got to sign that pianist. He's absolutely world-class. Sign him up. And I got a live recording of his, played to my wife, said, oh, wow, he is fantastic. That's how the whole thing started.
Well, let's hear a little bit of his list. We'll hear a bit of the concluding movement of the second piano concerto.
Thank you.
I think you couldn't ask for a more barn-burning ending than that one.
And he plays it musically, too. It's not just for him to showcase.
Well, that's an incredibly hard combination to find.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
To find the music and listen.
I want to say thank you so very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to have you, Klaus Heymann, here as our guest DJ.
Good talking to you, Anastasia.
Thank you.
Okay.